I'd like to remind all participants this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the IGO-INGO Protections Policy Development Process Workgroup Call on Wednesday, 23 January. On the call today we have Lanre Ayaji, Ilya Balyankov, Jim Bickoff, Avery Doya, Chuck Gomes, Alan Greenberg, Robin Gross, Stefan Hankins, Wolfgang Klingwachter, Kieran Malin-Cherryville, Christopher Rassi, Thomas Rickett, Greg Shatton, Claudia McMaster-Tamarit. We have apologies from Paul Diaz and Ken Stubbs. And from staff, we have Barry Cobb, Brian Beck, and myself, Julia Charvelin. May I remind all participants to please state their name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you, Julia. This is Thomas Rickert speaking, and I'm the chair of this working group. And before we continue with our agenda, I would like to ask whether there are any updates to the statements of interest. Hearing none and reading none in the chat, we can then proceed to the next agenda item, which is the status of the general counsel request. And I would like to invite you, Brian. Who's that? I thought somebody was trying to make him or herself heard. But now we're coming to the status of the general counsel request, and I would like to ask Brian Peck to give us an update. Brian, over to you.
Thank you, Thomas. Hello, everyone. This is Brian Peck from ICANN staff. As I mentioned last week, General Counsel has been working with outside councils to try to provide a complete response as possible. It also addresses specifically the scope of the questions asked. In light of some of the comments and requests from last week's meeting, I asked them to, at least try to provide or determine with the work of the outside councils a planned completion date, which we hope to provide on that. And so that's as much as I can, as I have at this point right now, but at the very least, try to provide a completion, a planned completion date for the completing the requested research and information.
Thank you, Brian. So we will keep that on our agenda and monitor our progress, and hopefully there will be some results in the very near future, which allows us to go to the third agenda item, which is the status of the SG, SC, SO, and AC input request. I can report to you that so far we have received three comments, the first of which was ELEC, and we have discussed the ELEC statement during last week's call. In the meantime, we have received further comments from the ISPCP and the registry stakeholder group. And I would like to give an opportunity to the representatives of these groups to present their statements briefly. May I ask whether Osvaldo is on the call? I think Osvaldo is not there because he's the representative of the ISPCP. Do we have David Maher on the call? No.
This is Barry. David's not on the call. Chuck was, but he got disconnected, so I suspect he may dial back in shortly.
Okay.
This is Chuck. I'm not disconnected. I just was on mute.
Okay, welcome, Chuck. Chuck, would you be in a position to show the group briefly through the registry stakeholder group's response?
Well, I wasn't prepared to do that, but I can give it a shot. I don't have it in front of me right now, but I think I can talk through it. David's the better person to do it because he was the primary author. I did contribute to it, though, as others did in the registry stakeholder group. First of all, let me start off by saying that there was a minority statement by the UPU, and it's important that you understand that. And in some of our introductory session, it was noted that not everybody agreed with the precise language that is in everything there, but we thought it was good to get it in, and that we will of course work with the group in this. So our basic premise was, I think, consistent with the Reserve Names Working Group, in that we think that any special protections that are given should be considered with caution, and that the any criteria for exceptions be done on an objective and measurable basis and fair to everybody that's involved. Our statement says that, you know, generally we're opposed to special protections. Again, that I think is consistent with the Reserve Names Working Group recommendations during the PDP process. We do qualify and say that we do support, as was communicated in the drafting process, we do support the recommendations of the IOC Red Cross drafting team. But generally, we're cautious about making special protections for names for reasons that people have all heard before, not only from us but from others. So take our statement, and you can read our statement yourself, and don't interpret it to mean that we're not going to work constructively in this group to try and reach solutions that most, if not all, of us can support. We are willing to do that. David and I sat down today. We both happen to be in Amsterdam for the Registrar meeting, and talked about this, and I can assure you that we were both on the same page that we're going to work with all of you and try to achieve the best possible solution in the efforts of this group.
Thank you, Chuck. I see Ellen's hand up. Ellen, do you have a question for Chuck?
Yes, I do.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, Chuck. The statement says you support the drafting team's recommendations on the Red Cross IOC issues. The drafting team's recommendations were to provide interim protection pending the outcome of this PDP. Is what you're really trying to say that you support those continued on the long term?
Not necessarily.
Then I'm not sure. I'm not sure why it's relevant to the discussion.
Well, maybe it's not, Alan.
Okay. I read that as implying you support continuing those protections as an outcome of this PDP. If
yeah,
that's not what you mean, you may want to make it really clear.
Oh, I just did, I think.
Okay.
Are there any further questions for Chuck?
Chuck, I meant in writing for future readers of the document. Thank you.
I'll leave that to Chuck. I'll leave that to David.
Okay.
Again, my question goes out to you, whether you have any further questions to Chuck regarding the statement or the submission made by the registry stakeholder group. There don't seem to be any. I have seen on the chat and as well in the participants list that Osvaldo has recently joined us. Osvaldo, can you hear me?
This is Barry. I think he's still trying to connect through the operator.
Okay. I guess we should then move on with our discussion, and I will get back to Osvaldo and ask him whether he is willing to show us through the ISPs. Input briefly and answer the questions that you may have regarding that comment. Regarding the next agenda item, which is the review of the shortlist prioritization per work package, I would like to make some introductory remarks. First of all, I think it was very encouraging to see that there have been a lot of contributions on the mailing list over the last 24 hours. I have to admit that it was quite difficult to digest all of them and be properly prepared for this call. But nonetheless, I would like to make some observations, and I would like to go on record with those. First of all, we have worked collaboratively on the spreadsheet to ensure that all views that are out there and that are represented by the various groups that want to participate in this policymaking effort are actually documented. There have been allegations that, it has been the issue, I should say, has been raised that comments made by the UPU have not been visible in the latest version of the spreadsheet. Barry has already responded to that on the mailing list, but I would like to reassure all of you that this may have been a technical glitch, but there was no intention whatsoever to suppress the views of certain participants or groups that are represented in this working group. The opposite is the case, and I will gladly re-emphasize this. The opposite is the case because the spreadsheet was meant to be a place where all the arguments go. So nothing shall be suppressed or taken out. This shall be the document that we can revert to in order to make sure that none of the arguments that are deemed relevant by certain participants of this group are actually forgotten. So, even if I have encouraged the participants of the subgroups to come up with a shortlist and maybe eliminate some of the factors, that is not meant to say that we entirely forget about the aspects that have been brought up. So they will be on file, they will all be included in the report, but nonetheless, given the huge number of arguments that have been made and the huge number of criteria and other factors that we have now gathered in the spreadsheet, I think it's now time for us to try to work on shortlisting those, because I'm sure that at least some of you will find some aspects more relevant than others, and I think we need to get some sense of a group view here. The word consensus has already also been mentioned in that aspect, and in fact, we are on a mission to work on consensus positions, and therefore, I think we should try to sound out and test the waters as to what aspects can reach consensus, near consensus, or where consensus is absent and other results may be found out. And in that regard, I find it important to make absolutely clear that in my email that I sent out to the list yesterday, I merely spoke about chances that might be good to get at least near consensus on one item. So I did not in any way state consensus that is already given. The exercise or my intention was merely to try to condense what I have heard and read to a lower number of factors. And I think we will need to work on that as we move along. I see Aubrey's hand up. So, Aubrey, would you like to comment on that?
Yes, I would. Thank you. This is Aubrey speaking. What I'd like to comment is I'd actually like to thank you for having tried to test consensus. For anyone that's read the working group guidelines, one of your tasks is to, whenever you think there may be a consensus in a place, to test it, to say, I think there may be consensus here. And it's your unfortunate task to get the slings and arrows of us shouting, no, no, not yet, not yet. So I really wanted to thank you for actually taking that role seriously and actually testing stuff and being willing to have us throw things at you. So thanks.
Thanks, Avery. That's actually very encouraging. And certainly I'm willing to take the heat for certain participants thinking that testing the waters is premature. But I think given the complexity of the issue that we're discussing, it is necessary every now and then to see where we stand. And should we end up finding out that all the groups keep their views and keep their diverging views and are not able to find some, at least some common ground as a basis to base a solution on, then I think we shouldn't waste everybody's time and call for a consensus call earlier, and then we have a result, and the result may be that no consensus is reached and that all views are so divergent that we can't come up with a conclusion. Now, having said that, I would like to actually take, if you permit, take my email of last evening to sort of introduce to the shortlisting exercise that we're then going to discuss for, in particular, the qualification criteria. Now, it is certainly unfortunate that Ricardo is not present on the call now, or let me ask whether he has joined in the meantime. Ricardo, are you there? He doesn't seem to be on the call, but you may recall that in my email I tried to slice and dice the issue a little bit and come up with a few ideas. And the first idea was to talk about the existing or planned RPMs. I thought that we were at least near consensus. At least I didn't hear any strong opposition to this, to recommend or at least to include a recommendation in our recommendations that the RPMs should be opened up so that the organizations asking for special protections are actually able to use them. Now, Ricardo has opposed to that, saying that the UPU as well as others have been opposing to the idea of curative RPMs. I have to admit, and I will take this offline with him to see clarification on that, but I have not read the submissions made by him and by other IGOs as being against opening the RPMs. I would just quote one sentence from the open letter from intergovernmental organizations. The letter is dated, I don't seem to be able to find the date right now, but I think there just has been one joint letter. And that says, the curative resource-intensive objection option currently foreseen for IGOs in ICANN's applicant guidebook fails to do justice to the above public policy and legal considerations. And I have taken that as a statement saying that additional protections would be required. I have not seen that as an opposition to making RPMs available to these organizations. I wouldn't be surprised if at least some of the organizations concerned would be happy if they could use the RPMs if only they were allowed to. And I think that Avery Doria has asked a question in the same direction on the list. But I would like to ask the participants of this call now whether there is any comment on that. Maybe other IGOs want to chime in and respond. So my question to make it very clear, is there any opposition to the idea of opening up RPMs to the potential beneficiaries of this working group or this policy?
Thomas?
Yes, that's Jim, isn't it?
Yes.
Jim, please go ahead.
I had read Guillermo's letter where he says that they are completely opposed to curative mechanisms as a matter of principle. But in any event, I think, speaking on behalf of the IOC, I think we're opposed to curative measures, too, for the two words that we're seeking special protection for. But we have other words that we would be happy to have curative provisions for, such as enhanced RPMs. And, in fact, I think that's sort of, you know, we have sort of two thoughts on that, one for words other than Olympic and Olympiad, and the other against RPMs, in the same way that Guillermo expressed it, as to the words that should be protected specially.
Let me ask you a follow-up question, and that is, certainly my intention asking the question is not to only open up the RPMs and leave it at that. The question is whether there are any objections to having the opening up of RPMs as one part of our discussion. So to put it bluntly, I think you wouldn't have any disadvantage of the RPMs being opened. What you're looking for extra protections, right? But I'm asking whether there's objection to the notion of opening up the RPMs as such.
No. No objection.
Okay. Ellen?
Yeah, I just wanted to, it's Ellen Greenberg, I just wanted to mention something that Jim alluded to, that the RPMs and certainly the UDRP, and if it were to be extended to IGO names, whatever it would be called then, is not just for exact matches. The UDRP applies to all sorts of other names, be they used in conjunction with, typos, whatever, which is a far wider level of, I won't say protection, but level of scope than we're talking about here. So I'd be very interested if indeed people are saying, no, they don't want that opened up. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Any further remarks or comments on this? So can we... I would seek clarification off list, as I mentioned earlier, but can we state that there is no opposition of the participants of this call? I'm not saying that this is the result of our work, right? So we will certainly put that out for, you know, there will be reports, public comment and stuff like that, so that's not the final outcome. But I just want to get a sense of whether... opening up the RPMs could be part of our recommendations and whether there's any objection to that. And I would just state now that I don't see any objection from the participants of this group. Now, as regards the second point, we have been talking about special protections requiring a special problem for certain groups or the potential beneficiaries. And I felt that the argument of additional costs, may they be for using RPMs, may they be for defensive registrations, or may they be administrative costs, has been perceived a weaker argument rather than others such as global public good or the violation or the harm to the reputation of organizations. And I would like to hear a comment on that statement. Let me put it the other way around. Is there anybody on the call who thinks that cost is or should be a decisive factor of our discussions. Claudia, you're typing. Why don't you? I take Ellen first, and then hopefully Claudia will jump in.
Yeah. Given that I'm
here.
Should I go first, Tomas?
Yes, please do.
Okay. It's Alan Greenberg. Given that I'm someone who's not particularly in favor of a lot of these protections, I would say cost is a major factor if the protections we offer will significantly lower that cost. If the cost of protecting your names through reserving names or registrations or defending it in UDRP is X, and by us giving these protections, we'll lower it by 0.01%, it's not a relevant issue. If it has significant impact on a large cost, it is relevant. So I think it will depend on what the metrics are.
Alan, let me ask you a follow-up question. Cost as a standalone pillar, I think, might be a vulnerable aspect because costs occur to trademark owners as well. So what do you think in terms of cost would separate the trademark owner from the name holder of an IGO or an INGO?
I think the difference is the public interest.
But wouldn't then the public interest be the cost of doing business?
One is the cost of doing business, and a lot of business has been opened up because of the internet, and there are costs associated with it. So, whether we should have done it better to begin with and avoided some of those costs, a good question. But we are where we are right now. Things where the public interest is involved, I think, become something that ICANN has to consider.
Which sort of supports the idea of putting the public interest first and not the cost. But your point is well taken. Aubrey.
Yeah, thank you. This is Aubrey. I think that costs are definitely a factor. I don't think they're a determining factor. I'm not quite sure I understand first factor, second factor, third factor. I'm not sure I understand an ordinality of factors, but rather tend to see that there are multiple factors. I think costs are also significant. I think, as Alan says, public interest. I could even see this group recommending tiered costs. So many things in the world have costs for one type of user and lower costs for the public interest, charity, what have you, users. So I think that there's a lot of ways in which costs can figure in. And I wouldn't call them the determinative factor, but certainly I think they need to figure in. Thanks.
Thank you, Aubrey. May I remind those who are not speaking to mute their microphones because we had had considerable background noise. So, Aubrey, summing up, and this is basically what, going back to my original question, cost as a standalone factor wouldn't help in your view, but cost in combination with other factors. And if that were true, that would also be a result or an answer.
This is Aubrey again following up. I don't see any factor as a standalone factor. So, yes, I think it is one of many.
Thank you. That's helpful. Now I'm not sure whether Kieran or Jim will speak up, but either of you, you're invited to speak now.
Okay. I think cost is part of resource dedication and would be a factor because it diverts resources from the use of funds for public interest. I think that taking the two words that we're seeking protection for, if they are given the protection that we're seeking, that would eliminate the registrability of over 17,000 domain names, which would be a substantial assist and a reduction of cost based on the number of new GTLDs multiplied by 2 by 9 languages. So I think it would be a significant help not only to us but to others who are seeking the protection.
Thanks, Jim. Greg, please.
This might be a little bit of a Me Too statement by the time the last few statements were made, but I think, you know, cost is important, and I think cost issues are different for IGOs and NGOs than they are for profit-seeking corporations. You know, not to minimize the cost and potentially the debilitating cost to profit-seeking entities, but I think for not-for-profits, where the idea is to maximize the amount of money going to the public good and the stated purpose of the organization, I think it's a different kind of issue, and not just a different degree of the issue, but really a different kind of issue, and I think you know, we need to recognize that. Thank you.
So, Greg, you would also see costs as one amongst other factors, or would you also accept it in isolation? The reason why I'm asking is that I have heard statements earlier, and I think I've even read those, where the request for special protection was based on a cost factor solidly. And I think if we could agree on eliminating that as a justification in itself, then it would help us in our discussion to know that cost plus other factors might do the trick.
Well, I guess I see things kind of differently, in the sense that I don't know if where we said that cost in isolation should be something that allows us to grant special protection. I mean, it's I think that the factors are all related, but I think that eliminating I don't know that we can really eliminate, you know, cost as a particularly important factor or concern. And I think it really fits with you know, in with a lot of other issues. But we'll see where this conversation goes. Thanks.
Yeah, the idea is not to eliminate costs, but to say that cost only consideration is not good enough. So that basically part of the answer will be cost plus other factors.
I guess we need to see what those other factors are.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Greg. Any further contributions on this one? So we will get back to the qualification. We will get back to this, talking about the qualification criteria. Just briefly, because I think it would be helpful for the group to sort of maybe get a clearer vision of how our discussion could be moved. And if you look at Roman 3 in my email, we now need to discuss what the problem is we're trying to solve. I think there have been requests by several members of this group to evidence a certain level of harm. This is not undisputed, as you know, or as you will have read. There are participants of the group who say that protection by law itself is good enough reason to provide for protections. Others have seen that differently, and we have recently received two statements or two emails regarding this. The first one having been sent by Ellen, who asked a couple of questions to fence in the problem or to provide a methodology how harm can be evidenced. And the second has been submitted by Avery, who also said something about the quantitative elements. And I would like to go through these points with you, if you agree, because I think that what we should bear in mind is that even though I do appreciate the fact that the group or parts of the group are asking to understand what the problem is that we're solving, so if nobody would benefit from a new protection than it would be moot to establish it in the first place. I am a little bit afraid that by putting on the table a huge number of extra factors requiring additional information, we might get lost in detail. So I would like to ask you to either come up with comments now or alternatively, if I don't see any hands in the next couple of seconds, I would then ask both Alan and Avery to explain a little bit about their thinking behind it. I see Greg's hand up. Greg, please.
Well, I think that the essential problem here is nobody here can predict the future. So trying to predict, with a high degree of accuracy, what the harm will be in the new GTLDs is, not something we can do. We can rely on our experiences to date with regard to harms and, what they might be. And I think that leaving this or narrowing this protection only to those who have already experienced domain name abuse, I think is cutting the cloth too narrowly. And I think that it's entirely unpredictable as to which organizations, may experience it in the future versus those that have in the past. And I think will also tend to favor organizations that perhaps have been more proactive in the past. And I don't think that necessarily should be a criteria. I'm especially concerned about smaller organizations in developing countries that have not necessarily taken proactive steps to seek protections. Again, there's something to me that seems fundamentally incorrect about, and part of this also depends on what protections we're talking about too, about kind of limiting all of this or large portions of this just to those who have already seen past harms and trying to use that to narrow the those who receive future protections.
Greg, Ellen is next in the queue, but I can't resist to make one comment. I think when it comes to harm, or at least that's my understanding of the conversation that we're having, Ellen is more or less asking for a good reason to do policy work on this and grant special protections at all. So in the absence of any justification allowing us to grant special protections to these to a certain group of organizations rather than to other groups or rather to anybody, the different question is whether each and every organization needs to prove that they have been harmed in order to be admitted to protections that might be put in place should the group recommend to do so. So I think that's the difficulty that we're facing. I'd like to pass on to Ellen.
I think I would be open to or find it more appropriate to look at harms. Let's say we looked at 100 IGOs and INGOs and found that 67 of them had experienced some form of harms in the past. The question is, are we going to only I would find it appropriate to say that the 100 that are similarly situated, even if they haven't experienced past harm, should all get the same protections because of their status as IGOs or INGOs, and use kind of the fact that certain organizations, as Alan has shown, have experienced fraud and abuse issues, and use that to extrapolate rather than use it as a sieve. Use it as a proof that IGOs and INGOs, as a class, experience these harms and that their money is being it would be better directed toward their stated purposes than toward stopping domain name abuse.
Thanks, Greg. Ellen?
Yeah, thank you. To go back to the original question, do we need a test like this, or should the laws be sufficient, or laws, treaties, whatever? And that's the question we're asking General Counsel. If General Counsel comes back and says, yes, there is absolutely no doubt that we are not, registries are not allowed to delegate delegate domains with, you know, IGO names at the second level, then our work is done. It's simple. But we haven't gotten that answer yet, and therefore we're presuming there is no straight line between the treaties and what a registry or registrar can do. That's the only presumption we can take until we're told otherwise. Now, I don't know where the idea came from that we would use past harms as the sieve for protection. What I am suggesting is that we not work in the dark, that we have some idea of what's going on. You know, I can try to predict where what the answers will be. I think we're going to find that for organizations that have a major internet presence with individual users, they can easily demonstrate past harms. And for organizations for whom it's a web page, which, to be honest, you know, no one who other than someone who's connected with it goes to visit or is pointed to by the Wikipedia because they're curious, are not likely to see a lot of harms. But without any information, we're working completely in the dark, and we can't construct that kind of classification that Greg is talking about. So, you know, it just seems foreign to me in this kind of environment to say we're going to essentially, I'll use a strong word, and forgive me, but we're going to hide the information, we're not going to disclose it, and you have to make your decisions without it. I think we need to know what's going on, and then we can try to make intelligent decisions based on what we find out. Thank you.
Alan, quick follow-up question. You have been a participant of the original drafting team, and you will recollect that documents and information has been provided by both the IOC and the RCRC. In your view, you said that you haven't seen any type of evidence.
I haven't seen any for IGOs and little for the two INGOs we're talking about, and I stand by that. I may have missed some document. I've seen long, exhaustive lists of examples of domain name abuse, but virtually all of them are names contained in or something like that. Very few of the ones that I've seen, and perhaps none, I'm not sure, are ones that would have been prevented if we give the kind of protections we're talking about.
Alan, I would like to apologize for misrepresenting your
statement. That's fine.
but nonetheless, the information that you've seen from the IOC and the RC, would you deem that sufficient information for you to answer the general question of harm being administered to the organizations?
No, I would not, because harm, to say that there is domain name abuse, to deny that would be rather foolish. It would be sticking your head in the ground, and I don't believe in that kind of concept. We know there is significant abuse of both of those, but it's not clear that exact match protection is going to alter that in a substantive way.
I will most likely get back to you with the question on whether the quite long list of criteria that you jotted down in your email shall be applied cumulatively or alternatively, or what subset of these criteria you might deem sufficient, because I think we would be well advised to narrow down the questions that are actually asked, should we decide to ask them. But first, let me take Avery, please.
Thank you. This is Avery. I wanted to take a couple words on the side of using them as metrics for admission. I actually do believe that a history of no abuses in particular name sets should definitely be a consideration on whether something is added to lists or not. I don't think, as I've said before, I don't think anything is the only consideration. I tend to see the considerations come in subsets where you have to meet one of set A, one of set B, three of set C. But I don't see saying, oh, that's irrelevant as an acceptable answer. I think history is somewhat part of the equation. In terms of getting those numbers and figuring out, as was presented in the admission questions, where various numbers were listed as variables, unknowns, you know, we need to see the same kinds of things that Alan's talking about. We got in our small group a little bit more stretched out in terms of let's see this data, let's see the pictures that this data gives us, so that we are actually making some fact-based determinations about what's reasonable to include, what's not reasonable to include, and at what levels, what thresholds, and for what metrics things are used in a sort of admission package. Thanks.
Avery, before I move to Claudia and then get back to Alan, I'd like to ask a follow-up question. Since you've been working on the admission subject and given this considerable thought, would you require, as Alan does, the evidence of harm to grant special protections in the first place, or would you use non-quantitative factors such as protections by treaties or other legal instruments to as being good enough to establish a program, and then just use the past harm or evidence of harm in the admission?
I think I would use it in both admission and earlier in the determination. First of all, I haven't seen, you know, any evidence of treaty that bars the use of words. And I know we're waiting for, legal to come back with something determinative on that. It's something I still haven't seen. So I tend to think that from the very first, it's a family of attributes. It's a set of attributes with subsets that have various boxes that have to be ticked off before you even get to the question of admission.
Thank you, Avery. Claudia.
Hi, Thomas. Claudia here. I would like to add a point of clarification, I think, on the discussion of the relevance of past expense or past existence or present existence of domain name abuse in this working group. One, there's the question of whether there should be special protection at all. And two, there is the question of who should qualify. For the question of whether there should be special protection at all, I think it's very much our position that cost is not the focus, should not be the focus. Showing numbers of expenditures, what percentage of your budget, the number of domain name abuses being tackled on a yearly basis should not be the focus, and in fact can be very dangerous and lead to an arbitrary name game, an arbitrary numbers game, that may or may not satisfy any particular member of this group, versus focusing on the public interest. And that is the reason why there should be, we feel, there should be protection, special protection in the domain names. Organizations that serve an international public interest need to be allowed to function according to their mandate, which may or may not include extensive resource allocation to domain name abuse, but rather allowing them to function towards working on an everyday basis to serve the global community. That's different than when we talk about who should qualify. Once we get past the question of whether there should be special protection, perhaps yes, perhaps because we need to protect the public interest and organizations that serve that public interest fall under that protection, then we can get to who should qualify. And perhaps here it may or may not be appropriate to look at internet presence or the existence of domain name abuses for example, as a factor, which can then be analyzed on a case-by-case basis. I really don't want to emphasize the importance, and as I said in my email before, the deep irony of requiring vulnerable organizations to put up some sort of a Excel sheet showing what percentage of their budget is spent on domain name abuse. I reckon that organizations that can spend extensive resources on domain name abuse may not be as vulnerable as those who show very little or who don't have the expertise to address that domain name abuse. So just to clarify, I would like to say we should be very clear about what we're talking about when we're talking about showing present or past domain name abuse and uses of names and acronyms and domain names. One is really, should there be protection, and I would argue that it there should be, and it should be to protect the public interest. That's very different than adding it as a factor when we discuss who should qualify. Thank you.
Thank you, Claudia. And Alan, I had threatened you for a while that I would get back to you asking whether you would like to see all criteria answered or responded to, or whether there is a subset. Is there anything that you would like to respond to that?
I think all the criteria I listed, plus the one I put in the chat that I don't quite know how to ask, and that is a measure of how outward-facing and user-oriented their internet presence is. So I could consider maybe we want to ask a subset of institutions or organizations the questions, but no, I think those questions are relevant.
So
I'll reiterate, I'm not saying if you don't meet the specific threshold of past abuse, you do not get protection. That is not what I'm saying. I'm simply saying we want to understand the environment we're working in a little bit better in trying to decide what protections are warranted and to whom.
Let me just seek clarification. This public-facing argument, that is one that can only be determined on an organization-by-organization basis. Well, I thought
ultimately, in the end, yes, that's correct.
But my understanding of your request was to ask for evidence of harm to answer the question whether generally a policy should be crafted granting special protection to the specific target groups.
Well, if for instance we can find virtually no evidence of any harm on with exact matches. Now, you know, there's plenty of, you know, based on the email I sent out, there are plenty of domains registered with exact matches, but they tend to be completely unrelated or they tend to be monetized. Now, I find monetization and park pages which simply have, you know, pay-per-click advertising on them, I find that to be something which I would prefer to see eradicated and erased from the face of the Internet. I think it confuses users. I think it gets in the way of them doing what they're trying to do. But we have no policy against it right now, and there are many, many people making many millions of dollars through that mechanism, and I'm not sure ICANN wants to be in the business of unilaterally putting them out of business unless we have a good policy basis for doing so. You know, if we thought of it earlier, we might have prevented it, but we didn't. So at this point, I don't know that we can demonstrate a lot of past harm or predict future harm because of exact matches. I'm not disputing the fact that there are nasty people out there who will take advantage of organizations. Of course there are. I'm just want to see some information about how much exact matches will impact this.
Thank you, Alan. Claudia. Claudia, are you on mute, maybe?
Hello, Thomas. Sorry, I realize I think I was on mute. I just would like to answer very quickly. I do think that there is a policy against monetizing certain names. The UDRP is one of them. There are also national legislations that might protect trademarks. However, that is a separate, that can be a separate discussion from what we are talking about here, in the sense of a lot of INGOs are not going to be able to divert their resources, both because it's not mandated, it's not a part of their mandate, and because quite frankly it's a daunting venture to try to tackle all the domain name misuses in the internet. Thereby, as I said before, it really the focus needs to be on protecting the public interest. As you mentioned before, the issue of cost really shouldn't be the focus. It's a problem for all organizations, and it's going to be very difficult to find what number would satisfy Alan, for example. It shouldn't be about this arbitrary numbers game. It needs to be about looking at organizations that have a very special mandate, that serve the international public interest, and protecting those names and acronyms, and not about showing how much money do they have to be able to fight domain name abuse. Thank you.
Thanks, Claudia. And this sets the scene quite nicely for the question that I'm going to ask now, and that is that I, as chair, am struggling with this very item, because I, in terms of process, I'm not sure what questions to ask in order to satisfy Alan or Alec, or you know, maybe other parts of the community. So would it be one per group of organizations that chose it that would satisfy the criteria? Would it be N organizations that need to provide this evidence? So I'm a little bit lost, and I would like to get more views on whether you find asking these questions relevant, and if so, what thresholds you would like to see, and on top of that, if we use thresholds to ensure that these may not be perceived or are not perceived arbitrary. So I would very much like to get some more views on that. Claudia, is your hand still up or is it up again?
Sorry, Thomas, I left it up. Thank you.
Not to worry. Can I take the silence as agreement or opposition to asking the question set out in Ellen's email?
I see it as an agreement, but there are other voices in the room.
Can you repeat it? I'm sorry. I lost the thread somewhere along the way, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm trying to answer here. Sorry.
Greg, sorry for this. My question is what the group's views is on the questions asked by Alan in his email of the 23rd. Because I'm puzzled as to what questions should be asked from how many organizations. You know, maybe Mary can clarify a little bit. Mary, there you go.
Thomas, that's very optimistic. I'm not sure I can. In fact, I hesitated to raise my hand because I'm not sure this is going to help, but I felt like I needed to ask this question because, like you, I think I'm struggling to try to find a path through this. First, let me say that I think a number of Alan's questions I think would be very useful. As you guys saw from the admission sub-team, we thought some of those would actually provide quite useful information. But I think the list of questions made me think about something that really goes back to what we're trying to do. And it's also connected to what Claudia said, that the basis should be something that's based on the global public interest. Now, that's a slippery slope, and that's a different discussion that I don't want to get into here. It also ties into what Chuck just sent to the mailing list, I think, on the emphasis being something that's objective. And again, that leads us down a numbers path I don't want to go into. But my question really was related to the harms discussion. And, you know, sometimes I think we use the words harms and abuse like they illustrate the same thing or are proven the same way. And I don't think they are in concept. So my question for the group is, if we're looking at something in that universe, you know, there's harm, there's damage, there's abuse, there's some problem there. Are we looking at abuse through registration, abuse through use of the name, abuse through use of the contents of the website, all of which are different? And are we assuming that that automatically means harm? I say that because of two things. One, I don't think they mean the same thing, even though they overlap significantly. And secondly, if we are talking about abuse, you know, a couple of years ago, the Registration Abuse Policies Working Group, if I got that right, Chuck, or somebody will correct me, discussed extensively and I think came up with some kind of working definition of abuse. Now, we may or may not find that helpful, but that's why I thought I would ask the question. Are we talking about abuse? Are we talking about harms? Are we talking about both? Are we talking about neither?
Thanks, Mary. That's certainly very helpful. Let me give a first shot at the answer, and that is that looking at both registration abuse and usage abuse, I think the only thing that we can tackle with this effort is registration abuse.
And Thomas, if I can jump back in with Mary again.
Sure.
That's what I thought as well, and I think that makes perfect sense from a principle as well as a practical point of view. So if that's what we're looking at, then I think we do need to look at the discussions of the RAP working group. And I do want to emphasize that doesn't automatically mean harms in exactly the same fashion.
Which is true. At the same time, my perception of this group's discussion was that, and this is why we have to, you know, we're talking about exact matches. We're not talking about similar strings or fraudster sites under unrelated domain names, which means that if we have identical matches to the organization's designations, and then on top of that there would be fraudulent activity that would even increase the harm, forgive me for using that word again, because the designation that has been used is particularly vulnerable. But I would be more than happy to get more views on that, because I think that helps us shape our mission. Since nobody wants to speak up, can I at least hear hear from you whether there is any objection to the way I summed up our mission? I'm not sure what's currently being typed in the chat, but so far I would take this as agreement that we're... Greg, you want to take the first shot at that, please?
I do generally agree with your statement. I agree with, you know, there's sites that have underlying abuse on them but use non-abusive domain names are clearly beyond the scope of what we can accomplish in this group. And, you know, all that we can expect to deal with here are strings that are on their face troublesome strings, and how we define that is part of the, you know, of our work. But I don't think, you know, that that getting into content analysis, certainly of sites that are not where the string on its face that is its domain name is not troublesome, is anywhere, you know, within our mandate. However, you know, going back to what Mary said, I don't necessarily think that the converse is true, that a site needs to have abusive content on it for it to be harm, for it to constitute harm in this case. And I think, you know, looking at some of Alan's comments in the chat here and some of the other comments, obviously there's many vigorous positions being taken. If somebody, you know, grabs up Universal Postal Union in 1,000 different new open domains and puts links on them and hopes to monetize it because of the great popularity of the UPU, that is a harm in and of itself, even if, frankly, regardless of what they put on the site, or even if it doesn't resolve.
Thanks, Greg. Now, as a next step, I think I don't see any alternative than getting back to Alan again, who is fortunately the author of the questions, but now unfortunately is exposed to all my Q&A. And that is, what is the quantitative element in your question? Not in terms of the specific figures in response to the questions, but would you like to see that data from one per group, one IGO, one INGO, or what would the threshold be? Because once we have clarity on that, I will ask the group whether they are willing to ask me as a chair to ask that questions of the potential beneficiaries. Because I think it wouldn't be a good idea just to throw out the questions and then let the organizations in question respond and then say, okay, well, we thought it should be one or two more. So I think in terms of transparency, the criterion that should be criteria that need to be met for Alex's concerns to be satisfied should be clear up front.
Yeah. Okay, a couple of things. First of all, that was my message, not an ALAC message. You know, I may or may not have had support on ALAC if I had passed by them, but that was my message coming from me as an individual. I wrote that late last night. If you look at the timestamp, you'll see that. I don't claim that the wording is exactly what we want to ask. I think we need to look at it carefully and make sure the wording is correct. So I would definitely not send out the request today. I think if we could come up with some measure of how outward-facing their Internet presence is, I think that would be another piece of the puzzle that would help us come to some conclusion. Again, my position. I suggested that we ask the groups that are asking for protection right now, not the ones that might be included, but the ones that are asking, and the ones that asked originally a year plus ago, were a list of IGOs in the letter that was sent in December 2011. And I think that's a reasonable letter, reasonable group to go back to. They cared enough to ask. Do we want to include other groups? UNICEF is clearly a very outward-facing organization that was not included in the list. Perhaps there are a few of those that we may find useful information from. But if I had, if I was king, I would ask that group at the very least and perhaps add a few more to it. And, whether that gives us the definitive answers we want, I don't know. I think we're working so much in the dark about past history, and I understand some people don't think past history matters, but for those of us who believe that we should be, if we're making rather radical Internet policy here, we should have some real rationale for doing it. As I said, if General Counsel comes back and tells us it's the law, fine, it's easy. In the absence of that, I think we need rationales. So I don't think I would alter what I said basically last night. I think the wording needs to be looked at carefully. We may want to add something to that. But basically, I put down what I thought was reasonable.
Thanks, Alan, and I apologize again for something that might appear picking on you. It's actually trying to get your expertise to the table, which is always much appreciated.
I understand. No good deed goes unpunished.
Thanks again. Greg, please.
Hi. I guess, Alan, you're the tall poppy on this particular issue, so therefore.
I knew what I was getting into when I sent it.
As a true Canadian, you don't like being the tall poppy. But in any case, I think there are a couple of things here. First off, I'm in no way opposed to fact finding. I think the more facts, the better. And getting information like this from IGOs and INGOs, would in no way be harmful or irrelevant. I think that one of the issues, and I think Alan, you keep going back to, and I'm not picking on you, just going through the statement.
Sure, you are.
That, that exact matches. May not protect much. I think there's in the current Internet environment, and putting aside the CCTLDs for the moment, although perhaps we shouldn't, know, there aren't that many GTLDs, and therefore there aren't that many exact matches that are available to be taken by others besides the IGO or INGO in question. In the new internet environment that we are entering, you know, putting aside .brand and putting aside what might be heavily regulated or exclusionary TLDs like .bank, where presumably with an arts organization would not be able to register, but neither would an illegitimate pretender to being that arts organization. We're still going to have hundreds and hundreds of potential venues for registration, and I think that it's the even in that kind of new environment, even exact matches are going to be a significant problem. I doubt that an organization, an OECD, is going to register in 900 open domains. The .wtf and .sucks and .app and .wherever they might be eligible to apply, but it's entirely possible, likely perhaps, that third parties will do so if they think that there is an advantage, a commercial advantage to be gained, or some sort of advantage to be gained by doing so. So I think the exact match problem is a problem, and I think that finding, if an organization has gone to the and taken its exact match in 15 of the 22 GTLDs, the fact that that they've done so isn't necessarily indicative that they would do it in 900 new GTLDs, and therefore it's makes it a little harder to extrapolate as to whether, in the absence of their having basically occupied their field currently, that they what would happen in that field in the future. But we should all have access to more rather than less information. The disagreement, I think, is kind of on what to do with that information and whether it's what function it should serve. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. Alain.
I was muted, sorry. Alain Béranger, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Thank you very much. I wanted to make a comment about the cost. The cost to INGOs, and I'm sensitive to the argument made by Claudia that the ones most that spend the most would be perhaps the less vulnerable. So I don't think we need numbers in a numbers game for qualification or. But I was wondering if this working group shouldn't have a sense of the facts and the data of these business costs. Yes, they're business costs. So and the reason why it may be important for us to have a sense of the importance or lack of relative importance of these costs is that they may be some community-based solutions, technical solutions that could provide these services with economies of scale that would be such that these costs of doing business would be reduced for IGOs and INGOs. And of course, this would link back to the public interest, because the less these IGOs and INGOs spend on administrative overhead and indirect costs, means that these monies would be going into their programs, their public good programs. So that is one of the reasons I'm curious about the extent of the cost gain currently being felt. And it would also be great to understand how the organizations can argue on a reasonable business case that the kind of protection they would get would actually reduce those business costs.
So you would like to add an additional question to the questions that that Alan has put in his email?
Well, Alan is more qualified to me as an academic to understand, to judge what value of the sample data that we would need in order to understand the total scope of the problem. But I'm quite comfortable with if Alan, if he's willing to add that question to put it in the way he sees fit.
I'm currently wondering whether the question you asked is implicitly asked in Alan's question, so that it could already be included in the answers. But I will take good note of that, and we might add a couple of words to that. Alan, please.
Yeah, two things. First of all, I used to work for a university, but I'm not an academic. I still do maintain the email address, though. I don't claim that is the definitive right set of questions. I think we are so much in the dark that it's the first stab at a right set of questions. Maybe we can do better by thinking about it and talking about it a little bit among those who want to see these answers. Or maybe there will have to be a second pass afterwards once we learn so much from the first one that we'll know what the right questions are to ask. This was just a stab to get somewhere from where we are right now, which I think is pretty much in the dark in terms of understanding the environment we're trying to change.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Alan. In practical terms, my suggestion to the group is that we will, based on the transcript, we will use Alan's list of questions. We will add the factors that have been mentioned mentioned on the chat and in your statements, and publish that on the list. And I would like to particularly invite those seeking protection to maybe come up with proposals to eliminate or to delete questions, or to ask put other questions where they might have answers at hand to the list, so that hopefully by next week we will have a set of questions that we can get some opinions on and send it out. Nonetheless, my understanding is that these questions are answered for the group to determine whether or not special protection should be granted at all or not. So I think this can go in parallel with the other discussions that we're currently having, because I think it would be too time-consuming to sequentially work on these issues. I see Stefan's hand up. Stefan, please.
Yes, thank you, Stefan Hankins, ICRC. Yes, I've been listening to the conversation. I had just a few comments. Obviously, we've heard all along the need and the concern that the harm and the prejudice be duly documented, etc. We have now discussed a range of criteria to that question. Obviously, then it also comes down to a question of threshold, numbers of abuse and fraud, effective prejudice, and so on, and then it gets extremely complicated. So I fail to see a little bit how the group will then be able to manage or to digest that information in order to how this information can be digested in the future to clarify whether or not the protections are due to the particular organizations. The second point is, again, as mentioned, but of course this is will depend potentially also on the legal counsel's determination, but certainly for the organizations, if the designations are duly protected under international law And actually, they are. I think Avery was making the comment that she had yet to see that. But, I mean, if you open some of the treaties we've actually referred to, it's really written in black and white. It doesn't take, you know, a doctorate in public international law to see that. It's written in black and white. And the last point is I note in Alan's various messages this question of exact match prevention, how is that likely to significantly help, and these types of questions. Well, I mean, quite evidently, if we wanted to take a case, I mean, it's evident that if there is a site which is called www.croixrougecamerounaise.org, and when you open it, you know, you have it includes, you know, the details of a bank account for donations because there has been a particular emergency in the country of Cameroon, then, I mean, it's actually pretty clear that, you know, the use of the designation in the site itself for, you know, someone who wants to donate to that particular emergency would cause an issue. And Stephane, lastly,
Stephane,
yes,
before we move to the,
yeah, Stephane, I just want to make one more comment.
Now, you will be allowed to make that, certainly, but just a quick intervention. The croixrougecamerounaise.org would not be prevented because we're only looking at identical strings. I think that's
important.
Yes,
that's my next point.
Okay.
That is my next point, which is, you know, if you are actually really looking at exact match prevention, as Alan suggests, it's not going to work. And it's not going to work for the reason you suggest, which is, I mean, I think we could argue that because the word Croix-Rouge is included in the name, I mean, it would obviously fall under the reservation. But I would go further, which is, you know, we need to find a mechanism that catches names that are liable to confusion, because the question or the risk, the prejudice is just as great. Whether, you know, you spell Cameroon in one way or other, it'll be exactly the same risk and prejudice to the Red Cross, Red Crescent organization in the instance.
Stephane, thank you for that.
I think that, you know, it comes back to, you know, the mechanisms, and that's another work stream. But I think the string similarity review has, as far as it is technically possible, is a requirement. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephane, and I apologize for cutting across you. I just didn't know how long your statement would be, and I wanted to make that point with the Croix-Rouge Camerounaise. Just some immediate feedback before I move on to Claudia, and that is that we are tasked with looking at protections of organizations' names and acronyms. That means identical matches. So the croixrougecamerounaise.org scenario would not be covered by the outcome of our work. And looking at identical matches versus similar strings is a different subject matter than the string similarity review, which is carried out when new GTLDs are being applied for. I would suggest, Stephane, that we take this off list and have a separate discussion offline on this, but I'm afraid that the two items that you're asking for are not covered by the piece of work that we're tasked with. Claudia, please.
Hi, Thomas. This is Claudia here. I would just like to lend my support to Stephane's last comment regarding the threshold issue. If we go down this road of asking organizations to provide specific numbers and then immediately saying these numbers are not enough or having some sort of hidden idea of what numbers would be enough, I think we run the risk of an exercise in being arbitrary. and perhaps even a biased, quite frankly. Not to mention, I'm not sure that that focus then really is different from the sort of trademark owner corporation concerns. There must be something different. There must be a reason why we are in this working group, and for me, that is that we are trying to serve, trying to protect an international public interest, not trying to protect the necessarily a sort of a budget exposition project, if that makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Claudia. That's very helpful. Greg, please.
I was just going to say that depending upon how we define an exact match, is that the Croix Rouge Camerounais, you know, could be an exact match. Presumably, that's the name of the Cameroon Red Cross. So,
it is.
I think when it wasn't, then I just wanted to correct that, or potentially correct that if it was incorrect.
Thanks. That helps. That's helpful, and we will take a look at that. Alan.
Yeah, two comments on the issue Greg just referenced and what Stefan was talking about earlier. All of those are strings contained in, and there's been an awful lot of work and investigation looking at that kind of thing. There's some real major problems associated with it, and that's perhaps one of the reasons why it is not something within our mandate right now. In terms of what Greg just said, yes, if indeed that's the name of the organization and it was in the list of names to be protected, it would satisfy. But at the moment, it was not in the list of things to be protected. A subset of that name is being protected, and that's a strings contained in issue, and that's not something that we're looking at the moment. It's something I support in many ways, but the implementation is really problematic. In terms of Claudia's intervention, it's rather unfortunate that we are now looking at solutions, and I am now at this late date proposing that we get some raw information to feed the discussion. I believe this is something that should have been done before we started talking about solutions. So the intent was not to get a metric that we apply immediately to a solution. The intent is just to try to find the lay of the land so we understand what the environment is that we're trying to change. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. And let me just add to what you said. You know, certainly this information should have been there in the first place, but I've asked you all for your patience and buy-in to an approach whereby we take various efforts in parallel. And the questions that you ask are an evolution of the nature of the problem subgroup spreadsheet, and therefore, you know, we have to take into account that these things happen, but I think that doesn't keep us away from making progress in other areas. Kieran and or Jim, please.
Yes, I just wanted to say, going back to something that was said before, and I think our mandate is on exact matches, but even on exact matches, if you multiply the number of domains by, the number of new domains by the number of words that are subject to special protection by the languages that are listed in the guidebook under the interim protection, which for us is 9 languages, that's still a sizable number of potential domains that would be cyber squatted that could be avoided. So I think it is definitely a great assist, although it will not solve the problems of similar strings, which would have to be dealt with separately.
Thanks, Jim. Greg?
I think Alan made reference to a list earlier in saying that Croix Rouge Camerounaise was not on a list. I think, you know, referring to lists that were used for, you know, the IOC-RC question earlier, I think misses the point of this working group, you know, which is to look at IGOs and INGOs generally, and that there are, you know, many local Red Cross and IOC organizations, among many others, that potentially could be within the ambit of this the exercise.
Thanks, Greg. Ellen?
Greg, point taken. but somebody better come up with that list soon, because if we end up deciding on protections, we're going to need it.
Well, I think they'll...
I was assuming for the Red Cross it was the same list. If that's not the case, someone should be saying so soon. Thank you.
Well, I think I assume the exact opposite, which is the part of this exercise will be to create a process by which organizations will submit names for protection, and not that we're somehow operating on any historical lists, because there are, you know, hundreds of, or you know, of IGOs and INGOs that we're considering. So that I would say that any prior lists are basically out the window.
Then we need another spreadsheet. We need another sheet in our spreadsheet about how to identify what the actual strings being protected are.
I'm not sure it requires another sheet. I think that in this process somewhere, and some of the stuff that's going on, discussion on the email list right now is on kind of, you know, creating kind of a trademark clearinghouse-like process by which organizations, you know, would name names and get put into the system, or that we would proactively, you know, reach out and identify organizations. That's, I think, part of the nature of I hate to say the word implementation, but let's say making this work, is to provide the input process by which names are put in. But I don't think we can assume that anything that has taken place up to this point has been intended to put names in or exclude names from consideration of the end result of this working group. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. And certainly the determination what names should go on the list, i.e. what names and acronyms of organizations are, is something that we will need to answer in the course of our work. But to sum this up, and I would like to end the discussion on this specific subject, as I said earlier, we're going to send the list of questions to the list. Unless I hear a lot of opposition from you now, we're going to refine that, add some points to it, extract it from the conversation we just had, and then ask the organizations seeking protection to provide information in response to those questions. Now, certainly there's the risk of the answers being evaluated, or you know, not knowing about the outcome. This is why I had asked earlier whether we can attach any threshold to that. But in the absence of any proposals regarding this, I think we should give it a try and try to get information on that. And maybe that will satisfy the whole group's needs for information, and we can then move on that basis. Before I ask Stefan to take the microphone, I would like to add one point regarding the trademark clearinghouse type approach that has been circulated on the list. I'm trying to carefully listen to you, monitor the chat as well as monitoring incoming emails, and I have to state that this idea or rough sketch of a potential technical implementation was allocated to Ricardo, and that is not true. It was actually a quote taken from an email, from my email yesterday. So just to be perfectly clear, that should not be attached to Ricardo. It's not his idea. It's an idea that not even I had, but that I have heard others saying, and I just try to put it into our discussion as a basis for our deliberations. Stefan, please.
Yes, thank you, Stefan Hankins. Yes, I just wanted to come back to this notion of exact matches, because to some degree, this somewhat of a novelty to us, because as we have made the point on several past calls, the actual designations that are protected under international law with regard to the Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Crystal are actually the designations themselves, not as the designations of specific Red Cross, Red Crescent organizations. So, and in addition, this notion of, you know, exact matches of names of organizations does not also fit the list of Red Cross, Red Crescent designations, which are today protected under the temporary moratorium and in the guidebook. So I have to say I'm a little bit confused. Of course, you know, the work of the previous working group had focused on the designations Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Crystal. That's what we were working on, and when you know this was moved into the IGO, INGO paradigm, we duly raised this issue. So, you know, I think there is a problem. There is a problem there, and certainly if we look at only the names of organizations, we're not going to address the actual protections as they are very clearly outlined in, you know, the international law treaties. So, you know, this is a little bit of a new notion to me that it's, you know, exact matches. So I just wanted this to be on the record. Thank you.
Does anybody in the group wish to comment on that? Otherwise, Stefan, I would, as I said earlier, I would suggest that we take this offline and go through the wording of the charter to get your question clarified. Is that acceptable to you?
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Now, trying to move forward. We would now leave the harm nature of the problem section and get to the qualification criteria section. And I have to say that I am a little bit hesitant to believe that we will be able to resolve this matter on the call. You have seen an attempt from Jim and Kieran to come up with a short list, and then we had sort of another statement from Claudia making a different suggestion. I think what is needed there is some more close interaction between those that wish to make themselves heard on the list to determine what type of legal protection is required, and because that is very closely linked to the number or the set of eligible parties. You know, we have the .ing proposal on the table. We have the treaties. We have protection by law. So I think we can't really go into the niceties of all this. Unless you would really like to dive into this for the remaining 20 minutes. But I would like to leave it with the encouragement to be active between this call and next week's call, and not only be active in the remaining 24 hours. But I think this is most important. That we talk about the qualification criteria. There's one question, though, and that is more fundamental, and that is whether you agree with the notion that the question of what level of legal protections is in place is maybe the decisive factor that we need to consider, and that other factors that have been brought up are supplementary factors. Any views on that? Stefan, I'm not sure whether your hand is still up or whether it's up again.
No, sorry, it's not. You can... I don't know. Thank you.
Thanks, Stefan. Does anybody wish to speak up regarding potential solutions in terms of the qualification criteria?
Thomas?
Jim, please go ahead.
No, I think your suggestion is a good one. Maybe... we can speak with Claudia offline and try to see if there's a way to, you know, resolve the differences in the directions we're taking.
Thanks, Jim. Claudia.
Hi, Thomas. Definitely, I welcome the invitation from Jim to talk further, but I would like to just assert that I don't think that shorter lists are necessarily better, nor is one or two criteria better than having on the table seven. I think we've said a couple times that there is a there might be need for having flexible or multifactored analysis in this kind of a complex situation. So I would just like to say I really hesitate any effort to unnecessarily abbreviate lists just for the sake of abbreviation. I've made an effort to summarize as much as I could the criteria into seven, including the protection of national laws and treaty laws, as well as others, that I think it's very, very important for us to keep on the table and to discuss and allow us the flexibility to include in any sort of recommendation that we will make a multifactored analysis that will allow us to have the flexibility that we truly require when making this kind of a complex judgment. Thank you.
Thanks, Claudia. That's helpful. Please note that my question, whether the list can be shrunk, is not something that the group has to follow. I'm just trying to find out whether there's enough common ground to determine certain factors as decisive. And if we were able to use a subset of these criteria to answer the question, that would make our discussions easier. But what I've seen so far is that we had diverging views that people or participants of this group sent to the list or submitted, and these stand against each other, basically, and these are not congruent. And I think what is needed at this stage is the willingness to come up with a group view, which doesn't mean a consensus, but that can be that we need different sets of criteria for the different groups. But I haven't seen a concrete proposal that can be discussed by the group that makes such differentiation. And I think we, if we need different sets of criteria that need to be applied, we should spell that out. So I'm not trying to force in any way consensus or a common view on these things, but I think what we need is actually a constructive proposal that serves the various groups seeking protection in a substantiated manner. Claudia, I haven't seen whether your hand was down in the meantime, so would you like to speak up?
Yes, please. I actually please. Raised it again. I would just like to give a little explanation of how I came, how we came together on the criteria that we proposed. The seven criteria that we've proposed summarize, in our belief, all of the criteria that have been discussed on the qualification criteria page, and we would posit that they can apply to all of the organizations that we're talking about, that is IGOs and INGOs, including the Red Cross and the IOC, and that I think one thing, Thomas, that I'm not sure we have answered as a group, which is how we intend to apply these criteria. Some of us speak as if we should find a silver bullet criteria, that this will be the one criteria if somehow we can satisfy there will be automatic protection, or whether we need to have a multifactored analysis. I would lend support to the latter. I think that we've had discussions regarding having some sort of flexibility to make a case-by-case analysis, because the evidence that will be provided to answer these criteria will be different and will require analysis. And so therefore, I would say that we do need to sort of put on the table whether we're talking about having requisite criteria or cumulative criteria, or if we're talking about some sort of a significant amount of the criteria being satisfied. Thank you.
Claudia, I think that's the answer. As much as I would like to have the silver bullet, I'm not stupid enough to believe there is one. So I think that we need to work on a more diverse approach. But I think we need to put that in writing. And this is why I said last week we're now moving from the spreadsheet format to text format, and we need to spell that out and come up with proposals that can be discussed and commented on. Mary, please.
Thanks, Thomas. With the price of silver the way it's going, I'll take the silver bullet if there is one. I'm going to grab that and offer what may be a really stupid suggestion, but I haven't had a chance to think this through, so let me know if you guys think it's really silly. I was trying to figure out, under the qualification criteria discussion, if there is a way to marry the clearinghouse approach with the list approach. And I was thinking about possibly a two-tier type of approach, so that in the first instance, you would go with the clearinghouse approach, so you would look at the exact match, right, the attempt to register at the second level an exact match that isn't coming from an organization that is connected to or authorized by, that particular organization, be it IOC, ICRC, or any of the INGOs. And that should be fairly objective, fairly easy to do, and easily understood, right? So that's the first instance. If we are not talking about an exact match, or we're talking about something outside of the clearinghouse universe, then you're looking at a second tier of the list. We still have to discuss the list.
Can you please, for those who do not speak, can you please mute your microphones?
Well, maybe they don't like my suggestion. But for the second tier, right, those that are not exact matches or not clear-cut solutions, then we're looking at some kind of list approach, and we still have to look at what the criterion is. But that, because that's not a silver bullet, that is more complex, that is more involved, and there needs to be some kind of expedited decision-maker or decision-making process to deal with that. Is that in structure even something that we are prepared to conceptually discuss?
I think we can discuss everything. Some immediate feedback while I give others the time to raise their hands. As regards the first tier, I think even if you had an exact match of an organization's name, we would still need to determine what an organization is that would be eligible to use this clearinghouse type RPM. So I think we're still stuck with the question, what an INGO, what type of legal protection we require to be eligible to use the service. And then another question that has already been touched upon a couple of times is, what about legitimate use? So even if there were an exact match, one would need to look at potential exemptions. Regarding the second tier, I would need to check that again against our charter, but my instant feedback would be that looking at variations or similar strings, and that's ultimately what I understood you propose, I think that wouldn't be covered by our charter. Ellen.
Thank you. Two things. With regard to your last comment, I just looked at the charter, and although I'm shocked to find it, because it may generate a lot more work for us, I can't find anything in there that limits it to exact match. It says we should consider protections and special protections. So maybe it's buried there, not using those words. I couldn't find it on a very quick perusal of it. In terms of both you and Mary have used the term a clearinghouse approach, I really appreciate if you've been more clear about what you're talking about. Currently the clearinghouse is used only for Sunrise and for claims notice. It doesn't prohibit anyone from doing anything. So it gives people first refusal prior to launch, and it will get a notice issued saying you may be violating something. Are you sure you're doing something okay? It sounds like we're talking about it here using the clearinghouse repository, but using it in a different way. So I prefer some clarity so I know what we're talking about. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Before I move to Mary, let me say that in the mission and scope, it says whether there is a need for special protections at the top and second level in all existing and new GTLDs for the names and acronyms of the following types of international organizations. So that I thought the group had decided would be our mandate narrowed down to names and acronyms, i.e. exact matches. Mary, please.
Thanks, Thomas. And let me take a couple of points. I think, first, Alan, I think you're absolutely right. We do need to be careful. And when I use the phrase clearinghouse approach, I meant clearinghouse with a small c. And really, it was just kind of a descriptive phrase. The idea is to have some kind of data check, right, at the very initial stage. And it should be something, like I said, that's easily done and clearly understood. And Thomas, as to the list, you're right, that there still needs to be some sense of what that universe of groups and organizations might be. But I think here's where you might want to have a shorter, clearer, precise list of who. Then at the second tier, and again, I said this might be a stupid idea, I probably shouldn't have used the exact match example. Not just because of the charter, but because for all kinds of reasons, not just personally, but from experience on the IRT and under the straw man and everything else, I think it would be exceedingly, let's say, risky for us to go down anything other than an exact match approach. So I was just thinking of if we go with a two-tier approach, and the first one is some kind of data checking similar to clearinghouse with a small c, are there going to be cases of names or acronyms or groups that would fall outside of that? If not, we're done. If yes, then maybe there needs to be a second tier. And this can be a discussion regardless of the match issue, which I agree should be exact match.
Thanks, Mary. Greg?
Two things. I think first, I was also thinking of the Trademark Clearinghouse as being a front end. But not considering that the Trademark Clearinghouse, or really the claims service, as being what we're considering as the back end, though, of course, in our list of potential RPMs and the like, it's not off the table. But I was, you know, in terms of the analogy, thinking of it, you know, being used, as Mary said, to kind of have a point of entry for names and a, you know, validation check once we have, you know, if we have criteria in play, at least being a potential model for how we assemble the list of lists of names. And I would disagree with Mary, though, in terms of the and yourself with, you know, in interpreting the charter as meaning that we're, you know, limited to exact matches. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. And with this, I would like to close the queue. We have 5 minutes left, I would like to use those to make some closing remarks and talk about next steps. First of all, if you look at the protection spreadsheet, you find a little bit more information in there about the idea of this trademark clearinghouse with a small c, as Mary now called it. Just for you to bear in mind, the idea is not to use exactly what is the trademark clearinghouse now with the claim service for launch periods and stuff. The idea is rather to have a central database where eligible parties can be registered and their strings can be registered so that from a central source checks can be carried out whether a registration causes concerns and needs further checking or not. And certainly such service can be made permanent, and it would allow for the group to put policy on top of that that would even allow for proper exemption procedures. I've very, very briefly outlined that. It's basically, again, food for thought, but having discussed this quite extensively with you collectively and with individuals over the last couple of months, I think that we need something new, basically, and that the existing RPMs wouldn't be qualified to do exactly what has been requested for us to think about. And I would like to encourage you to comment on that on the list. In terms of next steps, we will now start writing a report based on the spreadsheet. That is certainly a living document that we will add to. And the and my hope is that we have a first rough version of that document ready for the next call, so that we move from the spreadsheet to text format for people to comment on and to make it easier to put in longer statements without the limitations of a cell in an Excel spreadsheet. We will have our next call next week. The next call will still be at the same time, although in response to Ricardo's note on the mailing list, I have asked staff some time ago to look into rotating the starting times, so we might see changing starting times for future calls as well. And unless you have any urgent issues to discuss, I would very much like to end this call. It's 2 minutes to the hour. I would like to encourage you to respond on and discuss on the mailing list, or you can even team up and have telephone calls in the meantime. Please use whatever channels you deem appropriate to help our discussion, and I'm looking forward to an equally vivid debate next week. Thank you so much, and have a great day, great evening, great morning, whatever time zone you might be in. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.